The views and opinions of the host, guests, and callers of Radio Free ArfCom do not necessarily reflect those of AR15.com, BBS Radio, or their advertisers. When any techniques, skills, or theories are presented, they reflect the practices and opinions of the individual presenting them, but not necessarily those of Radio Free ArfCom, AR15.com, or BBS Radio. In all circumstances, Radio Free ArfCom, AR15.com, and BBS Radio expressly disclaim any liability that may result in the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begin.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Here we go.
Let's go.
Welcome to Radio Free ArfCom, the radio show for AR15.com. My name is Benjamin, and I'm the new host of the program. And just want to give you a little bit about me, your host, before we begin. I'm in the firearms industry. I happen to have a day job as a lowly gun store salesman, so hopefully we'll have some funny stuff to talk about in the Tales from the Gun Shop here along the way. Also a NRA-certified instructor for a couple disciplines, so I've got a lot of background in the firearms world, as well as doing some of this fun stuff in journalism and radio, and that's who I am. Tonight's show, we've got a couple guests coming up. Got some current events we're going to talk about. The show schedule will be roughly, we're going to talk to Joe from the NRA Institute for Legislative Action about the some of the ramifications of this McDonald verdict. We're also going to talk to John Wayne Tucker, who's a congressional candidate for Missouri's 3rd District and an avid AR-15 shooter as well. And we're also going to have an industry segment later on in the program where we're going to be talking to a gentleman by the name of Reed, who will be joining us from South Carolina. And he is a works for a distributor for some of the largest suppliers of firearms and hunting equipment and accessories and whatnot here in the country. In the news that I noticed, the new Army rifle rounds, I'll review the little brief here. A new round replaces the current M855 5.56 millimeter cartridge that has been used by U.S. troops since the early 1980s. The M855A1 offers a number of significant enhancements: improved hard target capability, increased dependability, consistent performance at all distances, improved accuracy, reduced muzzle flash, and a higher velocity. It's tailored for use in the M4, but also improves the performance of the M16 and M249 families of weapons. So there you have a new round for, hopefully, us AR-15 guys as well. General McChrystal, after all this Obama and Rolling Stone fiasco, has announced that he is retiring or quitting, however you want to look at it. Big news on the top of Drudge right now is that the we have some Russian spies out of the Cold War that have just been charged. Pretty interesting here. Apparently the secret agents were assigned to live here in the U.S. as married people and infiltrate the different universities and academia and American life in order to learn about our policymaking and how and see if they could possibly influence that. So that was a little interesting nugget right there at the top. Also, the Kagan Supreme Court nomination began this afternoon, and there are many out there that believe she may or may not be friendly to the Second Amendment in her views as a relatively left-wing individual and a member of the academic elite. So it'll be interesting to see if the politicians that are going to be questioning her will actually throw her some questions, and then if they do, if they will throw, if she will provide obfuscating softball answers, as in the Sotomayor hearings a couple years back. That remains to be seen. I have on the line with me now Joe from the NRA ILA, Institute for Legislative Action, and we're going to talk a little bit about the big news today, which is the McDonald versus City of Chicago. And basically what that ruling did was say that the gun policies is something that's going to be nationwide in terms of the Second Amendment applying to all the states and cities and towns across the country, and see where the policymakers end up and what they're going to do, and if Chicago does in fact try to further restrict the activities of law-abiding citizens wanting to carry firearms. Joe, are you here with me today, sir?
Hi, Ben. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well, thank you very much, and thanks for coming on the program. So the right here on the NRA website is a very couple, you know, big news. Obviously, the NRA hailing this victory on the Second Amendment freedom, and I guess that right now, is it too early to say that this is going to be great for us, or is it just going to kind of reinforce what happened with Heller? Do you think?
Well, Ben, I just one slight correction. I'm not with the Institute of Legislative Action, although I support them. I'm a board member with the NRA.
I apologize,
the reason why,
sir,
I make that distinction is that all board members are not spokesmen for the NRA and or the ILA. But to
I
your
gotcha.
Point, not a problem. To your point, today's decision is fantastic. It truly is. It's the end, and possibly the beginning, but the end to a lot of work on the behalf of a lot of citizens out there and a variety of organizations that have come together to assist, file amicus briefs, and basically bring forward what we all knew, that we had a right to self-defense in this country guaranteed by the Constitution. With the decision today, in the 5-4 decision written by Justice Alito, that now that it's incorporated and it's there for history, that it's just important, your right to self-defense, is it to your right to religion, freedom of speech, and the rest of the rights enumerated in the Constitution. It is a fantastic day. It does, again, build upon what Heller, which was a great day 2 years ago, but this way, Heller pertained to the federal enclave of the District of Columbia. What McDonald just did was incorporate all the states. So you're going to see a lot of things happening in the next couple months. What's going to happen, Ben, is that we're going to have to let this decision age a little bit. And when I say age, we have to let it sort itself out. We have to see how the decision is going to be laid against the cities, in particular New York City, Chicago, Washington, D.C., out in California. That's where it's going to be the most impact is going to be seen as a result of this, because that's where the most restrictions are.
Yeah, because those are obviously the most restrictive states in the country. It says here on the Washington Post, they have a story about it. And while it is nice to see them actually put the story up at all, knowing they're pretty clear anti-gun and left-wing bias, however, they do say, quoting Samuel Alito, quote, "It is clear that the framers counted the right to keep and bear arms among those fundamental rights necessary to our system of ordered liberty," end quote. And then, of course, they go on in the very next paragraph to say the victory might be more symbolic than substantive, going on to say that there are few cities have laws as restricted in Washington and Chicago. So I guess on the question that I would potentially raise would be, you know, what happened in D.C. as soon as they struck down as soon as they did the Heller decision was, you know, they begin to put in place new restrictions to make it even tougher for the for people to still buy a handgun, even though you could legally buy it. And they also said that with this ruling, it does have, you know, those sort of reasonable assurances and of not, you know, preventing those that couldn't have firearms anyway. So
we saw that, Ben, in the Heller decision, in specific, as you mentioned, in the District of Columbia. Now, there's been legislation, because of the federal enclave there, Congress controls what happens in that city. So there's been legislation to correct what physical obstacles they put in. What this is going to do, what today's decision is going to do, is knock down a lot of their, be it in the District of Columbia, be it in Mayor Daley's Chicago, Mayor Bloomberg's New York City. You're going to see immediate challenges to all these restrictions that heretofore have been, the states believe that they could pass whatever they wanted and impede upon our constitutional rights. Today's decision is landmark. It is something that we're all part of, and everybody should be basically taking the day, take a victory lap, because it just reaffirms that we do have a constitution in this country. And because individuals' personal agendas, Mayor Bloomberg to be one with his mayors against illegal guns, they want to sit there and organize themselves to be restrictive against our rights. So that's what's going to happen here. Yes, there are going to be some impediments thrown, some obstacles, some bulwarks worked up against us. But we're going to keep going forward. And as long as we can all get in the same boat and row together, I don't care what organization you belong to, just keep fighting for what is right. And as I always say, Ben, it's very simple to take up a cause when you have the Constitution of this country behind you. And that's what we reaffirmed today. It was fantastic. And it's something we look forward to. We're going to take on all these people and all these individuals who believe that it was not a right articulated in our Constitution. Now you're going to see a lot of things happen. It's going to take some time now. I'm going to caution everyone. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It's going to take some time.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, I think one of the things that's often forgotten, and I just was watching the Glenn Beck before the program started, and he had Justice Napolitano, not Justice, but Judge Napolitano as the guest host for the day, and he was interviewing a couple of these law scholars, and an interesting thing that I caught one of them say was rights granted by the Constitution, and I think politicians in particular, whether you want to call them politicians, lawyers, lawmakers, whatever, seem to forget the fact that our framers didn't grant us any rights. They enumerated rights given to us through our very existence by God or humanity or whatever your particular belief is. And again, all they were doing was enumerating those rights in the Constitution. Now, so I think it's interesting that we have to go through all this legislation and spend all this time and money and lawyers and effort to do what we should be allowed to do just by our birthright. So I would expect, though, that from what you were saying, this is sort of the beginning, these first two rungs of the ladder being Heller and McDonald in an additional, fight towards freedom.
Very, very well said, Ben. Yes. And I personally believe they're enumerated. Our God-given right, that the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's what the framers, if you go into the Federalist Papers, and you see those basically was the foundation or the draft copy, if you will, of our Constitution. But, yes, you are correct. This is the second rung. Hopefully there's not too many rungs, but sometimes the ladder's got to be built before you can scale. It's going to be a little bit of fight here and there, but the incorporation was huge. And it took us over 200 and, I believe, 30-something years now to get where we are. It shouldn't have been that. I think Judge Napolitano did a great job. Today I happen to catch that in Glenn Beck as well. Mr. McDonald should be just congratulated for starting this, sticking to his guns, pun intended. Ellen Gura did a great job. Paul Clement did a fantastic job. I think I was personally involved with a lot of the NRA state associations. We came in with the amicus brief. We all got together. We were involved. I know the Second Amendment Foundation was there. GOA filed an amicus brief. There was a whole bunch of friends of the court's brief on behalf of a lot of people. SCI got involved. So it's everybody, the sportsmen, the gun owners, the citizens, the patriots. Everybody got together on this. And that's what we need to do. We need to understand that we're all in the same boat. So if we go together, keep going forward, we'll take on whatever obstacle that the anti-gunners are going to put in place.
Do you find that many like-minded groups? I mean, obviously the NRA is the most well-known and largest of the what I call pro-freedom organizations. But do you find that other like-minded groups, you know, firearms, you know, enthusiasts and sportsmen, do they tend to band together these organizations when we have obvious challenges to our rights, or you know, or is it, do you find it difficult to lead those to sort of form those coalitions towards towards a coherent end?
Well, Ben, I'm a life member of basically every major pro-gun, pro-freedom organization out there. I believe in it that much. I'm also a member of, I think, 31 now NRA state affiliates throughout this, so it's 31 separate states. And variety of other pro-gun, from BCDL to a variety of other ones throughout the North Carolina concealed carry. There's a whole bunch of other organizations. To answer your question specifically, do we all play in the same sandbox together sometimes? Sometimes we don't. I often equate it to sausage making. It's a bad process, but the end result's pretty good. We all have the Constitution at heart. I would like to say we get together. I think I love coalition building. I love bringing people forward. That's why I've joined all these organizations. I think together we're unstoppable power. United will get a lot more done, but unfortunately sometimes groups start to fight. The anti-gun groups or the anti-freedom groups love to see it because they don't have to spend a dime. They don't have to spend a dime of their money or their dwindling treasuries because we take out each other. Sometimes it's driven by greed. Sometimes it's driven by personalities. But what we need to do, I think today's the best day to start, is to go forward and what other banner or organizations we happen to carry, we can all form up as a group and go forward as the pro-freedom, pro-Second Amendment Army. Doesn't make a difference what tribe you're from. We're all in the same situation. So as long as we get together, but specifically to your question, my friend, sometimes we don't play well. It's a shame, but we need to get over that like you would anywhere else.
Right. That's, you know, it's always good to hear that, you know, that people are trying to band together, but obviously it's, you know, you're facing this huge, difficult issue. But unlike most other things, or many other things that people tend to advocate and fight for, you do have the backing of the Constitution, as well as, you know, what most of us consider their human right to own firearms for defense, as well as, you know, sporting type activities as well.
Sure. What we try to do, and we always try to enumerate this and make it perfectly clear, the Second Amendment has nothing to do with hunting, even though I'm a hunter. It has nothing to do with marksmanship. It has everything to do with self-defense and protection against tyranny. So that's what we try to get out there, and we'll get them all together. And it's a big tent, and we can bring everybody in. And I have just as much fun with my hunting friends as I do with my three-gun friends, as I have with my precision rifle guys, as I do with my cowboy single-action shooting society, and all those kind of things. We're all under the – it all goes bang. And when I ran for the board of the NRA, my motto was from black powder to black rifle.
Right.
I was a candidate of choice, and I hold that very dear because I love to shoot anything, from a musket up into anything on the AR-15 platform.
I do think that gets lost on a lot of people because you have a lot of time. I mean, even now, you know, we still have people, you know, for example, come into the store and, you know, and I have my AR-15 sitting on my personal gun up on the rack that we used to, you know, potentially, God forbid, have to defend the shop with. But people still come in and say, well, hey, what do you need that for? And I said, you know, and I have the gun. Let me just describe it to you. It's an AR-15, but it's got the tactical gear, the rail, the aim point on it. You know, the whole nine yards. And they say, what do you use that for? And I said, I take it hog hunting. I'm, you know, so but you still have that reaction by a lot of people that they look at some guns as better or worse or more evil or less evil than others, which I think is kind of a shame. And I think it's oftentimes I find myself more of an educator than a salesman in many regards, trying to let people know that, hey, you know, this is the reality of the situation. There's something for everybody, and because I like a gun and you don't like a gun, doesn't mean that we're not all fighting for the same purpose.
Well, very well put. And, you know, we've been fighting this evil black rifle moniker for many years now, since the assault weapons ban, and thankfully the sun set federally. But here in New York, we still have it. And people look at this and they say, oh, why do you have this or why do you have that? Or, I mean, you can show them a 37 handgun, they think it's menacing, or a 44 mag. You show them an AR with, you know, all dressed out with the camo furniture and aim point or an ACOG or whatever you're going to have on that. And you hit it when you said you're an educator. If we take the time, 5 minutes out of our busy schedule, to sit there, grab somebody, take them to the range, expose them to what we are, show them what it's like, show them the hunting rifle in .223 or .30-30 or whatever they happen to take out into the woods with them, and then show them how it goes in the .223 over with the black furniture on it. It takes 5 minutes. And then the light clicks on, the light bulb goes off. And they, oh, okay. That's another thing we need to do. There's an educational component in all the advocacy we do then. Sit there, invite somebody to the range, take some time, shake their hand, invite them to, you know, wherever range I go to, whatever firearm I bring with me, I allow people to shoot. If they have an interest in it, I've got some exotic stuff. But if they come in there, I let them let it rock and roll with it. All good stuff. Because every once in a while, you can convert somebody.
Yep. I agree. Go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, I'm sorry. I go, a wise elected official told me one time, and I won't disclose his name, but maybe in subsequent interviews I will. Very liberal, and if I disclose his name, you should be shocked. But he said, and I think this is the heart, we came kind of close. He told me, you never know where your allies are. There's a lot of people who happen to be liberal-leaning, but they believe in our Constitution. So every once in a while, you can convert those people over to our side. Now, they probably won't be a flag-wearing, you know, card-carrying member of the NRA, but they understand their strict construction.
Right. One of the things that I picked up on when you were just saying, you know, well, you know, the difference, you know, and then you're talking about Chicago, New York, AR-15s. You know, I'm here in Florida, and I run a local gun shop here in Florida, and we have many of what we call snowbirds down here, which are residents of New York or Massachusetts or Connecticut, coming down here and to spend the winters, obviously, because of the climate and all that. At any rate, one of the things we tend to run into is, the snowbirds, and what happens with them is they come to Florida and they don't know what the laws are as far as not only what you can purchase, but also as far as what guns you're allowed to have in your home state. What are the laws as far as, you know, what firearms you can possess, what you can own. If I'm an out-of-state resident, where can I go with my gun? Can I travel with my firearm from Florida to New York? Do I have to be a resident? What's this and what's that? It's a huge ordeal, and we get people asking us all the time, well, what's the law in my state? What about if I'm a resident here or there? The problem that we often find is that we can or we can't sell somebody a gun based on, you know, the city or county, municipality, regulation where they happen to live. You obviously have the residency requirement, being, a state resident to purchase a handgun. So I'm interested, Joe, if there's some sort of coherent action that we can make the firearm laws in this country be one unified thing to avoid all this confusion among, you know, individuals who travel or different states. You know, if you're driving through New Jersey with a handgun on you, I mean, you're basically a felon. So that's just something that I thought you might like to comment on there.
Oh, sure. Well, Ben, there's a variety of things that govern us nationwide. What a lot of people are doing, I call it the personal defense cocktail. They are getting multiple pistol permits from a variety of different states to allow them to carry legally through reciprocity agreements through approximately, if you do the right mixture, 38. I think I'm up to 38 states now. That gives them license of privilege to carry the firearm per the code of the state they're traveling through. That's one safeguard. The other safeguard is that we have the ability for federal legislation to be in transit to go through every state in the union as long as we are legally, we can legally possess firearms in the home that we, of which we have a residence. So if you're, normally the time is 3 days. So if you're, say, coming through New York and or you're going to a training or a competition, and you have a letter from that competition or from the trainer, that kind of another bit of a safeguard. Now, to answer your question specific, are there legislation or is there a way we can look at it? Yes. We have a thing called here in the state, in this country called states' rights. So it's difficult for us to sit there and say, okay, New York, we want you to conform with South Carolina. Believe me, if that ever happened, then I'd be doing cartwheels. My good friends in North Carolina have fantastic gun laws. But it's something where that's why we have state houses and legislatures and what have you. It's difficult, so we try to get everybody on board, see if we can do it as a national carry. We came very close to a national reciprocity. We lost by 2 votes last year. The NRA is moving forward, bringing that forward to a vote again. Hopefully, after the 2010 midterm elections in November, we'll have some more horses that we can count on to come forward. We're going to try that. To have one law that like a cover-all law would be very difficult. I think the best thing we can do is hope for a national reciprocity, which we were close. Like I said, with 2 votes.
Yeah, I mean, that would be ideal because the situation that we have to go through, I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous sending people into the DMV, and then they say, well, okay, and you know, as an NRA instructor, you know, we have to be able to try to tell people, hey, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but here's, based on what we know, the best course of action. I mean, it makes it very difficult, in particular for the beginning enthusiast and for the beginning individual who's taken the step in the right direction and said, yes, I do want to have the ability and the means to defend my family, God forbid something disastrous should happen. So, you know, and I think, I don't call it what you will, but, I mean, it's in many places it's apparent that it seems like it's an effort in some ways, whether intentional or not, to prohibit more people from getting into the sport or getting into not even the sport, but the whole self-defense end of it, just because it's so difficult in so many places to have to jump through the hoops just to try to get a legally available means of self-protection.
Well, most certainly, Ben, and we're trying. I think we took a major step today. I'll call it a leap with the incorporation of the Second Amendment. So I think you're going to see the next fight on the battlefield, if I can use that, is each state and looking at their being a must or shall carry, streamlining their system. I know some of the most restrictive states, New York, Illinois, out in California, they're going to be looked at, and a lot of these the challenges are going to be posed to hopefully streamline the process. I think you're absolutely right. I think there's obstacles for a law-abiding citizen, and the operative word here is law-abiding, that goes through police their application. I'm going through what they have to do in New York. You have to be trained in safety, normally an NRA certification. From there, you have to fill out the application. Cost you a couple $100, go through the fingerprinting. You have to be vetted and subject yourself to a background investigation conducted by your local jurisdiction law enforcement agency. And then in Buffalo, New York, in Erie County, it should be about a year and a half if you're granted your permit. That's totally unacceptable. We're trying to work that down. There's a variety of reasons for that, Ben, and I think you're on point. A lot of times there's people who want you to go through the hoops. Some people who don't stay the course fall off to the wayside. So, in a sense, they're victorious in stemming the flow of getting their, again, law-abiding citizens protecting themselves or wanting to utilize their Second Amendment freedoms.
And I'm sure it's the same debate that anybody could have in talking to anybody else. I mean, we all know the obvious that they are trying to infringe upon it because it gives, you know, for whatever reason, they don't feel like, you know, like the Constitution either applies or us lowly citizens are too stupid or to be able to take the responsibility of owning the means to protect our families and yet still have to rely on the government and the infrastructure and the bureaucracy to try to, you know, protect our families when, I mean, about Supreme Court cases, I mean, you know, cops have no duty to protect you anyway. They're there to pick up the pieces. So, you know, where do we draw the line and say, hey, we need to have, you know, the ability to get law abiding, you know, get firearms in law abiding citizens? I mean, I tell customers all the time, I said, you know, the most important thing you can do now that you've made that and sometimes quantum leap into deciding that, yes, you are responsible for your own protection, now what you have to do, and I think a lot of times many gun shops in request of the dollar fail to properly educate and inform people of the need to train on how to use it, on how to shoot, on how to be effective. I think, you know, sometimes gun owners and gun shops in particular are their own worst enemy by treating people as if, you know, of course, you know, I'm in the business. Of course it's a business. Of course we have to pay the rent and pay money. But, hey, let's make sure that when these people leave, as a new gun owner, they join the NRA and they leave with a positive experience and a positive taste in their mouth.
I think that's very wise and sage advice to all our gun shops out there. I'll tell you, I've been very, especially at AR15.com, we have so many different trainers there. I've been very, very privileged to train with a great majority. Fry at MDTS in New York, PFC, Keith Prysik in Las Vegas, Gunsight in Arizona, Front Sight in Arizona or in Nevada. There's a variety of great trainers that frequent our site. Definitely looking to see what they offer. When we go in, when we sit there, and when, part of that in our earlier conversation about trying to bring a convert to the range, when you sit there and you show, and first of all, thank you very much for being a certified instructor. That's part of my board committee responsibilities. I'm on education and training, which brings all the certification of instructors, of which I'm one myself. Together, but thank you for doing that. We have a responsibility to train the person correctly. And the skills, you know, marksmanship, combat, instinctive shooting, making sure you know how to handle your firearm in the correct manner in a pressure situation are diminishable skills. What happens in my experience, Ben, is when I train people or train with them, is that if they're first make the step to get the application for the permit, to get the permit here in New York. They purchase the firearm, they get the training, that kind of thing. They put maybe a box of rounds through their firearm of choice, and if it's a handgun, they throw it in their underwear drawer or wherever they're going to put it, and that's about the last time they take it out, and because they feel they can defend themselves now. So you're absolutely correct. We have a responsibility. That's why I try to bring people to the range. The gun owners, the gun stores out there, I think all in all do a fantastic job. I really do. There are some that just don't because some believe it is a business. I'm very, very fortunate. I mean, a lot of good people who happen to own firearm stores, who are FFLs, and they're true patriots out there. So I think this is another little thing we need to polish up and support. And we do support our local guys, too. So
Yeah, that's a really big deal that, I mean, we don't like... When we have a customer come in and says, you know, hey, you know, I want to get a firearm. Oh, I don't ever want to shoot it. And it just, I mean, a look of sadness washes over my face every time I hear those words because it's like, you know, you're kind of missing the point. You know, do you have that mental mindset and that, you know, not just the mindset, but, I mean, if you purchase a handgun, I tell people all the time, handguns are really freaking hard to shoot unless you train and you practice with it. And you're saying the diminishing skill. I mean, heck, I you know, being in the summertime with family plans and barbecues and going to the beach and all that, I mean, I hadn't had time to get to the gun range in 3 weeks. And I picked up my Browning to shoot a couple clays, and they looked like they were going about 1,000 miles an hour because I hadn't done it in so long. So you're absolutely right in that the diminishing skill.
Well, I'll tell you, it's very humbling when you've been away from a while, from plays to precision shooting to whatever. You're not, you may have brought yourself up to a certain level, then put whatever firearm you're with aside, go back up to the range, and it is humbling. I'm going down next week, as a matter of fact, to Tactical Response Alumni Weekend. James Jaeger, another person that's on the site, fantastic instructor. We're going to go down there and put me back into shape and get me going and get my focus in the right direction. But that's right. What it's all about. We need to be sure that everybody takes the opportunity, once they make that step to lawfully own the firearm, to go out and practice with it. I mean, that's a big thing. And just to circle the wagons a little bit more, Ben, when people sit there and say, or they come into the store and they don't want to use it, or they just want to have it, or they sit there and see buy firearms and say, how can you have one of those, or what's wrong with you? But I always say to them, listen, if you don't want to exercise your Second Amendment rights, that's fine. But don't tell me I can't. So if they don't want to, that's fine. But just because you don't want to, don't tell me that I can't. So these are the things that we try to overcome. As a board member, I'm out there every single day trying to pass the message forward and make myself accessible to either the board at ARFCOM or what have you to try to get the reality of things. There's a lot of hype out there. There's a lot of different things, negativity. We don't need it anymore, Ben. We need to say, okay, today's the day. It's a new day dawning. We need to go forward. And as I mentioned earlier, we're all from different tribes, but we're all here together now. Let's make sure that we exercise the freedom correctly. It's a diminishing skill, so we get to a level where we're going to become proficient, because if we're going to use it for home defense, when you know what hits the fan, it's not going to be when we're sitting there ready for it.
Exactly.
No doubt we'll be laying, you know, in our bedroom. We're going to have concerns about our children if we have them, or our wife. It's going to be, you know, the dog's barking, or, you know, it's going to be always the day that you didn't expect it to happen. Heart's going to be racing. You're going to have, you know, diminished light conditions. So there's going to be different things. So if you don't prepare yourself for it, for that or anything on the street, it's going to be a situation where you may be at a disadvantage because you're going to be in a defensive mode as opposed to a proactive mode. So as long as we sit there and we go forward and we go out there, we celebrate our freedom, we go out and train, we have a good time, we invite youngsters in if they're legally allowed to be at the range. We talk to the people there who served our country, and God bless our troops. Because the majority of the older folks at our gun ranges and gun clubs are from that generation. Welcome them back, the new ones who are serving over there in the sandbox now. God bless them all. These are things where they're fighting for the freedoms. And Ben, the one thing that I guess is something that keeps me going on a day-to-day basis when I start hearing different bashing about this organization or that organization is when I talk to a serving member of the armed forces, and they sit there and they know that I'm on the board of the NRA or whatever I'm doing. They sit there and say, listen, I'm fighting abroad, but when I come home, the freedoms that I fought for are still sustained. And it's just something to see these people saying, listen, we're fighting there. You fight for me here domestically. And it's something where that's what we all collectively have to do.
That's
go forward.
Quite an honor.
It is an honor for them. And that's one thing that we also do at ARFCOM. We support our serving members of the troops from all varieties, branches of services, as well as those who have given the ultimate sacrifice or those who have been wounded in protection of our freedoms. We're also there for our first responders, and we're there for the patriots, the citizens, you and I and the next person next door, who takes the awesome responsibility of protecting their family on a daily basis.
Well, I couldn't have said it better, my friend. Thank you so much for your time. And we will be back with you probably next week. If you'd still like to come on, we'd be loving to have you.
Most certainly, Ben. Congratulations on getting the gig. We're going to miss John. He's become a dear friend of mine. We wish him well in his new endeavor. And if you need me for anything, I'll always be here.
Thanks, Joe. It was awesome talking to you. Have a great evening or wherever part of your country you're in. Thank you.
Okay, buddy. Have a great show. Bye-bye now.
Thank you. Well, that was a great conversation with the NRA's Joe, and The number to call into our program is 415-762-1161. If anybody would like to call in and comment or talk to me or have a chat, we'd be more than happy to accompany you. We're going to probably take a little break for about a minute or two to get our next guest online, and then we will be talking to John Wayne Tucker, who is running as an independent Republican for the Missouri 3rd Congressional District. He's got some really good stances on values with the family. We will have some good stances on the Second Amendment. He seems like a very down-to-earth guy. He's not a politician, my friends. He is a genuine individual. We're going to have a little quick break, and we will be right back with Mr. John Wayne Tucker. Thanks, everybody. Back on Radio Free ARFCOM, with me is John Wayne Tucker for Congress, the Independent Conservative Republican. He has an excellent website for the office that he's running for, the Missouri 3rd Congressional District Candidate for U.S. Congress. On his campaign issues, he has number one, man of faith, number two, fiscally responsible, number three, pro-life. And he's got a very nice bulletin point of his list of basic beliefs. And the one that many of our listeners are probably most concerned with is he is a Second Amendment absolutist. How you doing, Mr. Tucker? And I'm really glad you could join me this evening.
Well, thank you, Benjamin. I'm happy to be here. I guess if I was any better, I'd have to be twins.
Yes, sir. You have a very nice website that's very informative. I've been looking through it. And you don't seem like you're going to hold back as far as with speaking your mind. Have you found that to be a great way not only to live life but also to reach out to your potential voters?
Well, I think it's a very important thing that people express where they stand on things, especially if you're talking about the political scene. I'm not a politician. I want people to know exactly where I am. I'm not going to tell someone that I support the particular issue just because I think that's what they want to hear so that I can get elected. Because it's not about me. It's about the country. It's about the 3rd District of Missouri. And so I want to make sure that they know exactly what I'm standing for. My position is always, if you don't like the things that I say I stand for, well, then you shouldn't vote for me.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, from what you have here, I mean, it's quite a breath of fresh air where someone, and like I said, I don't want to call you a politician, so I apologize if I slip up, but people in elected office or those that running for elected office, and like I was saying earlier when we were discussing the Kagan hearings, I mean, in the Sotomayor hearing for Supreme Court a couple years ago, I mean, it was nothing but obfuscating and these answers that didn't say anything at all. It was like, if this person is supposed to be in a position of republic government, you know, representing the people, you know, whatever the political or judicial or executive office be, they need to go out and say, hey, let's tell the people what we're about instead of just saying half truths and not taking an actual position on any of the issues. You seem to be the total opposite of that, judging by what we've got here.
Well, I think that people are really tired of that. Politicians go on the air all the time, and they use a kind of double speak so that they can never be pinned down, and then they never have to answer to anyone. They don't make either side angry. And they don't make either side happy either. So I don't see the point in it for me, because this is not, you know, I'm not a career politician. I'm not trying to become president. I'm not seeking any more power than what the people are going to lend to me. So the people's power, they're lending it to me. I'm going there to represent them, and they should know where I stand on the things. On the issues. And so I see no reason for a person who has nothing to hide to just come out and say, this is my position.
You know, it's interesting what you just said, because that's the very same attitude that many of our founding fathers had. They didn't look at becoming an elected official as a position of power. They looked at it from a position of honor. They were honored that the people chose them, and they would do everything that they could to not screw up and to not, you know, blatantly be a politician. And they were really there to actually represent the people and defend the Constitution for what and when the principles that the country was founded on. I mean, those the words you just spoke were very similar to those of, you know, Washington and Jefferson and all that, and in terms of the respect for not only the office and holding that in the highest regard, but also their morals and the Constitution. I mean, we were founded by individuals that supported, you know, they were advocates of strong morals, because, you know, in a free society, that's all we really have.
Exactly, and that's what made the country great from the very beginning. We had people that were really dedicated to doing what was the right thing. There were many who were candidates for president, for example, who said, well, you know, I'm not really qualified for that job. And so, but they elected them anyway, and they're historically great people. So, yeah, I think that's a good thing to do. I think it's a breath of fresh air for the people to actually see a real person running who understands those things. I taught American history and government for almost 30 years in the public schools, and so I know all of those stories, and I know the background of how we got to the places that we are. And you're absolutely saying the truth when you say that these people were more concerned with the republic than they were with what is history going to think about us. But because of who they were, and because of their strong morality, and because of their strong commitment and doing the right thing when they were in office, we remember them more than we remember many of the other people.
Now, I'm looking at your website here, and you have on your campaign issues tab, and that's johnwaynetucker.com for any of you that are interested. And these things are not radical ideas by any sense of the imagination. These are the issues and the stands that I think probably 90% of this country believes in. Well, I'd like to hope that for the most part they believe in that, but I'm not going to read them off. But there's about a half dozen or so of these basic beliefs here. you know, defending values, English, the Tenth Amendment, states' rights, Second Amendment, freedoms, the economy, life, you know, very, very, you know, what you would think are core American values to a lot of people. And I think that, you know, you might, I'd say only, but only running for the U.S. Congress. I mean, these are things that I think, I mean, heck, if you told me you were running for president, you'd certainly have my vote with this platform. I mean, it's unbelievable to see somebody coming out and supporting traditional conservative American values and stating it without pulling any punches.
Well, I don't know anything else to do, Benjamin. This is who I am. I'm a minister as well as having spent 30 years in teaching, so everything that I've done has been centered around service. And I've always believed these core values, as you mentioned, are the core values that I grew up with. Our neighborhood believed it, our churches believed it, our state believed it, our communities, our people. This is the American tradition. This is who we have always been. And the direction that we're heading right now bears little resemblance to it. And so I remember the greatness that came out of these values. And if we can get back to these values and principles, I believe that that greatness will be back again.
Do you feel like in the political arena, as you, I mean, I'm sure you're well read, and keep in terms, most of us keep in terms of current events and watching the news, but also you obviously a history teacher, so you were an expert on that. I love reading history and reading about the things where we came from and how our country was founded. You know, my earlier guest was saying, you know, the Federalist Documents, where the whole idea for everything came from. You know, where in this, you know, of your beliefs do you see not just the strongest part of your belief, but also sort of the weakest part of the current government that's in place and where we've sort of gone astray?
Well, the government that's in place right now, as far as I'm concerned, has a completely different agenda than our founding fathers had. Our founding fathers' agenda centered around a Judeo-Christian belief, and it centered around the fact that God was with us and God would move us into the future, and that the future was very bright for us. And we held things in common. That's what a nation is. We have common borders, we have common government, we have common language, we have common religion, we have common everything. That's what makes a nation cohesive. And so the direction that we are heading right now, as far as I'm concerned, is purely socialistic. People are vying to get something for nothing. People don't have value systems anymore. They're losing this. They're losing the religious values as well as any other moral values. The country's lost its moral compass. It has become all about me, and that me aspect is not just the people, but it's the people that are being sent to Washington too. They're there about me. And so we just can't have a nation where everybody's got their hand out saying, gimme, 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 and make my life better, and not ever think about anybody else or think about what they're doing to the country.
Well, I think that's sort of a double-edged sword also. I mean, because the me part can be good if people are willing to work. You know, we get a lot of the we in the socialist aspect of it, but also a lot of the me is in I want mine and I don't have to work for it. When it used to be me, I want to make life better for me, my family, my employees, my community, then you have what I would consider the positive me of, you know, a lowercase Republican style capitalist society.
Certainly, I would agree with that, and that's the way we have functioned and grown and been a great society throughout history, when people have thought about things in the way that you just described them.
So sort of getting back to that, where do you think that the process lies? I mean, obviously, if you look at the current situation, I mean, and we were just talking with our previous guest about, these crazy rules and regulations for absolutely everything we do, whether it be purchase a firearm, to, apply for a new driver's license, pick it, and it's out there, and it's regulated, and it's taxed, and the government has some finger in it. Where do we we've got this huge, grown, overbloated bureaucracy that, they were talking about the unemployment numbers a couple weeks back, and the government's growing jobs, but is that really what we need? I mean, don't we need to get back to, letting people live their lives?
Well, if you want to be like ancient Rome, where almost everybody was on the dole, as they called it, or working for the government, well, we're headed in that direction, certainly, and we know what happened to them. But, yes, government is way too large, and it encompasses too many things, and it is too intrusive into our lives. And when you stop and think about it, we've spent over 200 years with every day somebody's making a law or multiple laws, and all across the state, and we've got it at federal levels, we've got it at state levels, we've got it at local levels, we've got all of these microcosms of government that are creating their own laws. I've been trying to find how many federal laws have been passed since the country began. And I don't think anybody's ever researched or looked into that. But you know that it has to be a phenomenally enormous number. And what we probably need to do is start cutting back on a lot of those laws and regulations, because the more laws you make, the more it becomes intrusive into the individual lives. And America has always been about freedom. And I don't know how old you are, but I certainly remember when we had a whole lot more freedom than we have now. And I'm sure you can remember that, and I'm certain that a lot of your listeners can remember when we had more freedom than we do now. You can't even speak your mind anymore. We've become so politically correct that you're going to get in trouble and have to go to a school or a class or somewhere. So the first thing that we need to do is get rid of some laws. We need to get rid of some government bureaucracies. There is redundancy, which is costing us a horrific amount of money. And we've got to get rid of that redundancy. We've got to get rid of that waste. And we're going to save a lot of money that way. We've got to close our borders. If we have to put the tanks down there, I don't care what we have to do. Electrified fence, build concrete walls, and put troops down there, armed troops, whatever it takes. I don't care. We've got to stop those people from coming in. It's an invasion of our country. There are places in the United States now where you can't even go. The government is saying it's not safe for you to go to these places in the United States because of the illegal gangs that are there. And I'm saying that, that's costing about $120,000 per illegal, and estimates run as high as 40 to 50 million. Illegals in our country right now. And you start factoring in that cost, you can see that it's just an enormous cost. So we've got so many problems right now, it's hard for me to even address that question, because it just goes on and on and on and on.
Right. Yeah, it would be interesting to see a candidate run on not passing laws, but repealing laws. I mean, I think that's so backwards to most politicians' thoughts that it wouldn't even enter their minds of, hey, let's not go in there thinking we need to do something and pass more and more stuff. It'd be nice if they actually, didn't get elected and start passing a bunch of laws, but rather started thinking about, okay, where do we need to cut back? But unfortunately, I don't think that's a very popular sentiment in Washington, because these people have to justify their budgets and their kickbacks and their pork to back to their home areas, and the whole seeping corruption oozing out of Washington.
Well, I think it's going to become a popular thing. I think more and more people are beginning to realize that government has just become too large, too intrusive, and the fact of the matter is that we cannot maintain it at these levels. The cost of maintaining this monstrosity that we've created is beyond us. We can't keep printing money. Ever since they took us off the gold and silver standard, actually we were on the silver standard at that time. That was under the Kennedy-Johnson administration. And then Nixon put the nail in the coffin when he passed the final things that allowed the Fed to just print money. And that's what we do. All this money that Obama has spent that is supposed to pump up the economy is monopoly money. They just print it.
And I say that one of the worst things that happens to any, you know, Mr. Smith goes to Washington type candidates with the intention of going in and coming in with fresh ideas is that the you know, the leeches and they just immediately starting to bite and infect with the, you know, with corruption and sort of water down your message. And how do you intend on dealing with that should you be elected? I mean, it's a scary thing. Particularly, I mean, looking at what you stand for, I mean, I would hate to see any of these things get compromised because they are these ideals that we're founded on as a country.
Well, my answer to that is very simple, because I've seen good guys go to Washington and come out bad. Gephardt, for example, who used to be the congressman for this particular district, was a good guy when he went there. But they dangled in front of him the White House, and he wanted that badly enough that he followed them wherever they wanted him to go. And that's the problem with sending a politician to Washington. You're sending someone there that is politically motivated for wealth, power, prestige, or a bigger job. Then he's going to follow that party wherever they tell him to go because he knows that's what he has to do to be able to get that. I do not want to be president. I'm giving back half of my congressional salary to this district, so I'm not going there for money, and I'm doing that for the duration of the time that I will be in office. And my values I have held all of my life are not for sale. They have nothing to offer me. There's nothing they can offer me to make me change who I am and what I am.
That's bravo, sir, to you, because that's very nice to hear from anybody, really, willing, you know, in today's society. I mean, people just don't have any type of moral fiber or any belief other than in themselves and what can it do for me. I mean, I had a very interesting experience personally this morning of that very issue where I had someone who I thought was a friend and we found out was, you know, in it because of what benefits him as opposed to, you know, the give and take of a friendship or the give and take that should come from, you know, a representative, you know, trying to represent his district. And I think a lot of that, it goes down to one of your main talking points here, or your belief issues, in that the family, value, and morals coming under attack from, you know, whatever you want to call it, pop culture, mainstream media. You know, where do you even begin with the stuff that they have on, you know, I'm not one for censorship. I mean, I was a journalism major, but, God, some of the stuff that they say and do on TV now is just ridiculous. I mean, you're totally degrading and devaluing the family, the responsible mother and father and everything else. And it's a shame, really. It's awful nice to hear somebody who will stand up for those values.
Well, thank you, and of course, this is who I am, and I can't do anything but that, because I grew up in a time when that was valued, and so it's ingrained in me, and that's apparently what is lacking in a lot of the people that we're sending out as leaders today. And of course, you mentioned the marriage and family values, and I would like to mention this. This is something that a lot of people don't realize. We have a problem with marriage absence in our country, and the problem is that the laws of the government actually make being married less attractive, which is a socialistic kind of underpinning type thing where you end up with gender wars, et cetera, and things like this. And what happens is that then you have two families that you have to support instead of one, when it already takes one and a half salaries to maintain one household. So the natural solution that the government came up with was, well, we will subsidize those families, and that's our social welfare system. So by not having laws that are favorable to and conducive to happy marriages and families and family values, we've actually created a social welfare system that costs us untold millions of dollars. We don't even know, the research hasn't even been done to find out how much, but it's enormous. And there's cost saving right there in enormous amounts, and people would be happier.
And you would think, you know, saying, well, go to school, get your education, find a loving, healthy, faithful relationship. You know, if you believe so, go to church on Sunday. Otherwise, follow your, you know, moral compass with a conscience and everything else. Get married, be faithful to your spouse, have children, get a good job. I mean, these aren't radical ideas. I mean, this is what we all grew up with, at least it used to be, and I can't see, you know, people wonder what's going wrong. You know, don't spend more money than you have. You know, these seem to be pretty darn simple issues that not only have most of America forgotten, but they've also been, you know, given a free hand from the government to vote themselves, you know, largesse at the cost to the taxpayers.
Exactly, and I think you're right on. It's not a hard concept. None of morality, none of goodness, none of these things that we're talking about today are difficult or radical concepts at all. The radical concepts and the difficult concepts are the ones that are trying to cram down our throats and tell us that that's going to make us happy, when we know, in fact, that we used to be happier.
Let's move on to the gun rights part, because obviously here you definitely are a gun rights advocate, which we appreciate. You've got a really awesome video on you shooting your personally owned AR-15. What make is that firearm there, sir?
That's a Bushmaster.
Bushmaster.
And it's a nice little gun, not quite as nice as the one in the raffle, but it's a nice little gun. I enjoy that.
What do you enjoy most? I mean, are you a big hunter? Do you like target? You said you're a member of the local firearms club here in your area. What do you enjoy doing?
Yeah, I'm a member of the Arnold Rifle and Pistol Club, and I just like to go out and shoot targets. That's great excitement. I don't hunt. But as we know, gun ownership is not about hunting. It's about a lot of different things. And I carry, of course, personal protection. I've got my car 9mm on right now as I speak to you. I like to carry my 40 caliber Glock whenever possible. I just like guns. I think they're a beautiful thing to me. They're like cars. I love cars. I love guns. They're like a work of art in steel. So everything about them is interesting to me. But I don't hunt. But I do like to be able to protect myself. I feel much more comfortable when I'm walking around in a lot of areas when I know that I've got my weapon with me. And I like to go out to the range and just enjoy a day out there with friends, and we talk about the guns, we talk about whatever, and we shoot, and it's fun.
That's excellent. It's nice to hear that everybody, you know, that's the one thing that we find all the time, and particularly I was telling the guests in my audience, you know, I do run a gun store for my day job, and it's nice to see people of all walks of life, and it's hard to find. You know, there's a lot of different gun owners out there, but it's like once you find out that somebody, is a gun owner and enjoys the shooting sports and disciplines, whether it be hunting, whether it be doing tactical shooting, whether it be shooting skeet or trap, it's, you know, you always have somebody in common. And once you sort of break that ice, it's really a great way to meet new people and to have a good, you know, friendships and everything else develop through it.
Exactly. You know, in the car hobby, that's true, and in the gun hobby, that's true. And I've got so many hobbies that I've made a lot of friends in a lot of different walks of life that are interested in a lot of different things. And so it's absolutely true. You strike up an immediate friendship with someone just being able to discuss the various aspects of a particular set of weapons.
Yeah, the I'm looking here at your gun rights page, and I mean, some of these laws, like the 1934 NFA, the 1968 GCA, the FOPA of 1986, I mean, some of this stuff, I mean, nearly even the most recent one, 86, seems like, for a lot of people, a long time ago, these laws have been enshrined in our national conscience and sort of, you know, we've been programmed in, and from, at least for me, from birth, that all these are just the law and that's the way it is. And, you know, where do we go as far as getting rid of some of this stuff that infringes on our rights?
Well, see, this is the problem. If you put people in office that make these kinds of laws, you'll lose some freedom. And we've lost freedoms. We've lost freedoms down the line. The Bill of Rights is just critical. The states would not go along with the United States Constitution until they were sure that they had a Bill of Rights to protect their rights and to protect the rights of the states and the rights of the citizens. And so the problem is that once you allow somebody to take away some of those rights for whatever reason, then it's very difficult to ever get those rights back. So the best thing that you can do is send people there to positions of, I hate to say leadership, because once again, I recognize that you're just lending me your power, but you know, most people think in terms of leadership, and so it's a bad thing to send people to Washington or to any government office that does not hold true the value of our freedoms. Once we lose them, it is very difficult to get them back.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think it seems like as soon as you pass a law in Congress, it's like, you know, how can you ever get it back? I mean, look at I'm sure a lot of the conservatives will be potentially running on a platform in November of trying to repeal the health care bill, for a very stout example. I mean, where do we even begin? It's like once these mechanisms, you know, it's like throwing the snowball down the hill. Once that avalanche starts going, it's, how do you stop it?
Well, it is difficult. It's going to be very difficult. There's no doubt about it. I'll tell you up front, it's going to be difficult. And if I can't do the things that I promised, and if you looked at my pledge to America there, I said very clearly, if I can't do the things that I promised, I'm going to leave Washington. I'm going to come back. I'm going to tell you why it can't be done. But I intend to go there and accomplish some of those things. But it's going to be very difficult to do that, and the people are going to have to stand behind me in doing that. That's part of my reason for going there. I want to repeal that bill. If I had been there the last time, I ran in 2008, if I had made it there last time, that would have been one less vote for that thing, and
right,
one more person out there lobbying against it. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. So I've got to get there this time before it's too late, before more things are passed that are a problem. But it's definitely going to take the support of the people, and I'm going to work with the people of the United States and garner their support, too, in helping us to bring back some of our rights and freedoms that have been lost. And it's just critical. We just absolutely have to do that.
What do you think it's going to take for you to win out this election? I mean, are you feeling good? How are you polling? Do you think that people are hearing your message? Are you getting out there? Are you, you know, or do you feel, you know, a momentum building for you?
A momentum is definitely building, and we are really coming on strong. The problem that I face, of course, is that right now I could say, you know, if I had another $5,000, it's that close. If I had another $5,000, I could really finish out this this primary section really with great strength. And I'm certain that be able to take that, running against a guy that is the party choice. But he's a good old boy, a lawyer from New Jersey. By a good old boy, I mean he's somebody that's been raised up in the political system. He's just another politician who's out there saying what he thinks the people want to hear. He has no issues page. He ducked out on a debate yesterday with me. He left 10 minutes before the debate. He's done that twice. He doesn't want to be seen with me. I can't get pressed very easily. These things are difficult to overcome, but we've done it. We've overcome most of that.
The message is difficult to get out, basically?
The message is difficult to get out, yes, but we've been to places and we've done things and we've got that message out. And we're coming on strong. And what I'm saying is that now I need to be able to afford the last minute things that it's going to take to deliver the knockout punch here. And we're going to do it. We're going to do it.
What do you find has been the most difficult part of this? I mean, you say you ran in 2008. I mean, is this like a full-time commitment to try to get this thing and get your message out? I mean, I can't see that how it couldn't be. It seems like between the media exposure and trying to, you know, talk to guys like us, you know, it seems like you have a huge amount of stuff on your plate to try to really get that message out.
It is an enormous job, and I started this back in 2007, and I've been running ever since for this particular office. In the 2008 election, I ran against four people, and I only had $720. I had no volunteers, and I had no staff at all, and I took more than 33% of the vote. I just almost won against a guy that was endorsed by the party and spent $100,000. And so this time, I have an all-volunteer staff, and I want people to know that we're being fiscally responsible even in the even in running the campaign. There is no paid staff. It's all-volunteer staff. Every penny of every dollar that people give us, we spend toward making this winning this election a reality. And we don't waste it on anything. To get the message out.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. We have a caller for you. It's Dave from Menlo Park, California, with a question for John. Go ahead.
Hey, John.
Hello, David.
Yeah, can you, your homepage has a great piece on eminent domain, and could you just explain to me a little more what your main point is on eminent domain? It's a huge issue. Nationally, land rights, et cetera, but is there one particular part of it that really gets to you that you feel that you can change when you get sent to D.C.?
Well, eminent domain, of course, is the ability of the government to just take your property, condemn it, and they have to pay you for it. That, fortunately, was put in the Constitution. Now, you can all understand that there are good uses of eminent domain. For example, we would never get a national highway built. I watched them build the Highway 55 right next to me when I was a little boy, and it was great fun to watch all that happen, but all those people had to be removed in order to make it possible for that highway to be built. Well, we all know that you couldn't build a highway if you didn't have the ability to use eminent domain. But lately, there's been criminal use of eminent domain. They want to take somebody's property just so they can put in a strip mall. Somebody's property, maybe somebody's got a business that they're running there, but they want to bring in a big chain, a better-known business. So they want to condemn their property and take it and then put a different business in there. And those are all misuses and abuses of eminent domain, and we're seeing it all over the country. They've just taken eminent domain and they've used it any way they want to.
Does that answer your question, Dave?
Tell me what he couldn't do as a congressman from Missouri to change the eminent domain law to make it more just, I guess. That would be my question.
Well, you know, here again, a lot of these things are being used by state and local governments, and many of them have their own state and local laws. So in that case, we'd have to revert to the Constitution of the United States. What does it say? And we'd have to get some kind of ruling there. But I would push certainly to clarify once again in the minds of state and local people that they can't just take property. That's not what this clause or this portion of the Constitution says. It states that it has to be for public use. So I would make it very clear to people that if they are making criminal use of it, that there are going to be some consequences for that.
That, to me, for both of you guys, sounds like a very similar issue to what we're facing in the Supreme Court with the gun rights issues, because you have this sort of discrepancy. We all want states' rights. We want the states to be able to do what they, you know, to manage problems locally and statewide and all this versus, well, how do we sort of balance that with making it, you know, making uniform, you know, some uniform laws, like we were talking about the gun laws and the concealed carry permits, and of course, you know, if you leave the eminent domain to the states, you know, kind of, if you have horrible draconian laws in one state, you know, they can take anything you want for any reason versus, you know, a free state where, hey, you know, you can't take people's property without just compensation, and just compensation being, you know, fair market value, not just what the government estimator comes up with.
Right, and of course, we're fortunate here in that the United States Constitution addresses specifically eminent domain, and so the federal law does supersede the state law in this case. And so they have to follow the lead and the concept of the Founding Fathers regarding eminent domain as well as gun rights. And it's strange that there are states that want to say, well, we want to restrict guns in our state and make a state law, when it was the states in the very beginning that came to the federal government and said, hey, you can't take away our guns. And so when the Second Amendment was put into effect, as far as I'm concerned, all government was completely out of the gun control business.
As well it should have been. Mr. Tucker, do you have any parting words before we have our next guest on?
Well, I would like for people to please visit my website, johnwaynetucker.com. And I want people to please remember that anything I do as a United States congressman affects the entire country. So if you find a real conservative, you find a guy that really stands for the Constitution, you find a real person, wherever they are in the United States, I hope you'll support them. There's a donate button on my website. There's a pledge on my website that no politician would ever sign. And I created it for myself. But look at my pledge. Please consider donating to this campaign. Like I said, another $5,000 would make all the difference in the world for us right now. And we hope that you'll stick with us all the way through to the victory in November. But right now we're worried about August the 3rd, or we're concerned about it. We've got to get through August the 3rd before we can do anything for you in November.
Sir, it's been a pleasure and an honor. I just want to let you know that it's been great talking to you, and you feel free to come back and talk to us anytime, and we're hoping that you win this thing, and if and when you do, we definitely want you on the main line from Washington telling us what's going on there and how you're preventing the rest of the politicians over there from getting over on us little guys. Thank you, sir.
Benjamin, you can depend on it. Thank you.
Have a great night. Next, we will have Reed Finch. He works for a distributor company that sells all kinds of goodies, from firearms to optics, hunting accessories, reloading material, all the good stuff. We're going to take a tiny little break while we get him on the line. If anybody would like to call in or has any questions, the number is 415-762-1161. You're listening to Radio Free ARFCOM. To Radio Free ARFCOM. With me is a guest and a friend. His name is Reed Finch. He works for a major distributor of all the fun stuff that we like to take out to the range and out to the field. And we're going to talk a little shop and talk about what's hot, what's not, what's selling, what's sitting, and all the fun stuff that goes along with dealing with little gun shop guys like myself. Reed, are you there, buddy?
I'm here, Ben. Pleasure to talk to you tonight, buddy.
How you doing, sir?
Good, good.
How's the gun selling business going from your end? Now, you, just for a little background, are a wholesaler, and he deals with little shops like myself and trying to get us products, get us good deals, get us the stuff that people are clamoring for, getting the new guns in, getting all the good stuff before I ever get to put my greasy hands on it.
Yeah, that's pretty much what we do. But it's been really good. Business has been booming, thanks to the new guy in office, who I'm not a big fan of, but that's neither here nor there. But, I mean, it's just been great. One thing that we have been noticing in the industry is the need for concealed carry guns. That has just gone through the roof. And, I mean, I can't really put my finger on any maker model. But it's just more or less that's concealable and it's carryable. I mean, everybody's wanting it, you know.
Have you noticed manufacturers beginning to produce a wider variety and a wider selection? I mean, it used to be, you know, years ago, it was, you know, you had a Walther PPK or a 38 Special, and that was it.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it really has jumped leaps and bounds. Smith & Wesson will be releasing. It was supposed to be sometime this month, but it looks like it's probably next month. Their Bodyguard series and the 38 Special and the 380. Those are going to incorporate the you know, laser sight systems and this and that, which is really taking off as well. But, you know, it's just the sky's the limit as far as concealed carry. And because it's one of those tight markets where it's to each his own. You know, some people are wheel gun guys. Some people like, you know, semi-autos and this and that. But, man, these big manufacturers are just jumping on this bandwagon like no tomorrow.
So you're finding that everybody's trying to put out, to pump out their own version of the concealed carry, the lightweight wheel guns. I mean, you can look at the LCP from Ruger, their automatic pistol. You can look at the LCR from Ruger, their revolver. I mean, just from a retail level, I mean, we sell the crap out of those guns, and it's hard to keep them in stock. I mean, how do you guys keep up with the demand? I mean, I'm only one shop. Where do you guys... How do you keep up with the demand for this stuff from the manufacturers? I mean, are they really pumping out that many guns?
They are. I mean, it's just one of those things. You know, you guys ask for it, and we deliver on it, or do our best. Let's put it that way. You know, we're here for you guys, and you guys are the reason we're here, and everything else. It's a fun time and a scary time, I guess you can say, to be in the gun industry. But it's a lot of fun.
Everybody's been talking about the whole black rifle market slowing down, whether it be AKs, ARs. I mean, we've noticed that the prices are coming down on the AKs, the ARs. I mean, are you still moving the volume of those things that you were, say, a year ago?
Pretty much, for lack of a better word, the big scare that we had, you know, about 2 years ago when, you know, who got in office, you know,
right.
When I was running the gun store that I was running, I mean, we did astronomical, and I'm sure every gun store across the United States did astronomical numbers that day. I mean, it was unreal. I mean, if it went bang, it was gone off the shelves in 2 seconds, you know. Are those numbers as strong as they were then? I kind of see the market getting filled back up with them. You know, whereas before, on like a local level, you know, you pick up a little trader or go to a gun show, you know, people are asking way over market value for the gun because you just couldn't get your hands on them. Now they're coming back around, and it seems to be lightening up. You know, my thing is, if you got one now, great, go out and buy another one. You know,
that's what we try to tell our customers too. One's
because you can never have too many. You know,
that's right. It's interesting you say that, though, because, I mean, you know, I remember Election Day in 2008, and I'm not going to inform anybody of who I voted for or didn't vote for, but the first thing I did, I still had my I Vote sticker from the office on and went straight to the local gun shop before the shop that I work at now was even open, went straight to the local gun shop and picked up a new AK. Because
yep.
It was my way of not only voting with my vote, but voting with my wallet.
That's it.
And I think
that's it.
There's a lot of other people that I'm sure that did that too. And then of course, the following year, you know, the rush on the guns was just incredible. I mean, do you think that the industry can sustain this sort of breakneck pace? I mean, sure, we've come down a little bit in price, we've come down a little bit in volume, but do you think we can really sustain this type of, you know, activity as far as not just the, well, in particular, the black guns?
I think we can. I mean, this is nothing new for this industry. You know, I mean, we have seen this happen long before, you know, I was even involved in the gun industry. You know, it's one of those things that it's kind of, it ebbs and flows type deal. You know, we will be okay. The gun industry is going to be okay because, you know, bottom line, it's our Second Amendment right to have them. And when people start pointing fingers and try to take them from us, you know, it's one of those things to where, you know, no, they're ours and we're going to have them. And, you know, and the thing is, you know, our future of our sport, you know, with the younger shooters growing up, that's one thing that I've always enjoyed is just getting somebody new involved in the sport. I was at my local shooting range a couple weeks ago, you know, shooting my new AK-47 and stuff like that. I'd done some mods to it and whatnot. And there was a lady and her son sitting there at the shooting bench, and he was shooting a .22. And believe it or not, she goes, you wouldn't happen to be involved with the Boy Scouts or nothing like that, are you? And I said, no, ma'am, I'm not. And she goes with my son shooting for his you know, his marksman merit badge or whatever. And she saw my AK laying there and my ARs laying there and a couple pistols and this and that. And she goes, oh, my goodness, those look intimidating. I said, no, that's just a gun. And I said, have you ever shot one? And she goes, no. I said, well, why don't you pick one up and shoot it? You know, so I gave her the rundown, showed her how to operate it and all this good stuff. And she was shooting it. And this was like a, you know, a 40-something-year-old mom who had never picked up one of these the day before in her life. And her son, his eyes got just as big as the moon, you know. So he came over there. I said, you want to shoot? And he goes, man, I'd love to. He's about 11 years old. So he was shooting it, and he was having the biggest time, and they thoroughly enjoyed it. And to me, that's the great, great part about our sport is just getting new people involved who, you know, would look at these guns before or anything like that and go, oh, my goodness, what is that? And once you put one in their hands and show them how fun it can be, then that speaks volumes because she walked away from that shooting range going, you know what, I just shot something that was really cool.
Well, I hope that that Krylon job you did, like I showed you on that AK, didn't turn out too bad and scare away, brother. Hey, we've got Jeanette from Connecticut online. If she'd like to ask Reed or myself a question, we'd be happy to take her call.
Yeah.
Jeanette,
Hello.
Are you there?
Hello?
Jeanette, are you there? You're on Radio Free ARFCOM. Go ahead.
I'm looking for Visible by Numbers.
Reed, I'm not sure what that was, but if
I'm not either, Ben.
Yeah, she called the wrong show, my producer says. That's excellent. But yeah, you know, like I was saying, boy, you got to get that Krylon so it covers all that scary black furniture on those black guns. Speaking of furniture, how's the accessory business treating you guys? I mean, are you still selling much of the, you know, your ACOGs, your EOTechs, your furniture type stuff?
Selling a lot of that. The accessory market is booming right now. I mean, there's so many different manufacturers out there coming up with such cool new products. It's just unreal. You know, I mean, it's like every day when I go into work, we get, you know, new reps coming in from all these manufacturers and this and that. And they're just showing us all this new product. Some of it's not even out yet. Some of it's still in the workings. And it's just amazing.
What's some of the cool stuff that you've seen lately?
Goodness gracious, you name it, you know. Laser Light's got a bunch of cool stuff out. They got a really neat bayonet for a pistol, you know. That believe it or not, it's a great seller. It's just a cool little wow impulsive buy, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's just off the top of my head, NC Star, you know. They've got a really cool product out. Not trying to endorse either one of them in particular, but just those are the ones just popping my mind. You know, I mean, they put out great products and, you know, stuff like that. But it's just really neat.
What would you say that, you know, aside from the obvious, you know, popularity of the 380s, you know, or I shouldn't say 380s, but your concealed carry style guns or your black rifles, which are obviously, you know, still popular due to, you know, the political climates and whatnot. What stands out in your mind as being something that's really moving a lot of volume with product wise in terms of firearms? What are people really getting hot over?
Honestly, I mean, not to answer a question with a question, but I mean, that would be, you know, what you see on your front, on the retail end, you know, people coming in on your end going, Ben, I've got to have this.
Right.
You know, when's this coming out? Stuff like that.
Well,
you know,
we typically find that in the retail end of it, the gun magazines tend to do a whole lot to boost the business for whatever particular product that they feature. I mean, it's a relatively savvy campaign, whether you look at, you know, articles and write-ups that are, you know, legitimate editorial features, but also the ads for stuff. I mean, you put the ads in there, and the people are going to come in and they're going to ask for it. And there might be one person that asks for it. There might be 10, but they will ask for it. And so, you know, do you sort of see that trend, you know, when you look at the advertising campaign from just off the top of my head? I mean, look what the Torres Judge did. I mean, they put an incredible ad campaign together, and we have to have one in the store or else people won't even shop there. I mean, have you seen that, you know, that correlation between the media presence and the and what you're moving?
I do. You definitely get a lot more calls and a lot more hits the more product knowledge is out there, whether it be, you know, various shooting magazines, you know, guns and ammo, you know, tactical magazines, stuff like that. You'll constantly get those calls on a particular item. But it's, you know, it's pretty much up to the manufacturers to really put it out there and stuff like that.
Are you seeing, given that the fact that nowadays we are living in 2010, you know, are you seeing a level of innovation and technology in the firearms industry that could potentially have been unthought of in terms, you know, years ago in terms of not only the firearms but the ammunition as well?
Oh yeah, most definitely. You know, Hornady's got an awesome round out of their Super Performance. It's just a great round. Nosler, I mean, they've jumped through leaps and bounds, and I mean, they're constantly improving this stuff to where it's unreal. It's almost, you know, for lack of a better word, simple to use. Whether it be your optics, whether it be, you know, your gun itself, just the craftsmanship involved in making them. So there's a lot out there that's really good, and a lot of it's, you know, really comparable. Some of
what
it.
What do you think? Go ahead. Sorry. That,
no, it's okay. I was just going to say, you know, some of it's better than others, but bottom line, it's always going to be you get what you pay for. You know.
Where do you see in not just the immediate future, which would be one thing, but also down the road? You know, ammo availability is always on the mind of many of the posters on AR15.com, and it's like, hey, where can I find ammo? American Defense. Plug myself.
That's what I was about to say. Go talk to Ben.
But, but getting back to the subject at hand, I mean, you know, people are always posting and asking questions, hey, where do I find ammo? Or, hey, look at me, you know, I just scored, you know, some 380. And it's like, you know, okay, dude, I have 380. I have, you know, 40 boxes in stock or whatever. But, you know, where do you see the demand for ammo kind of shaping up? And not just the hard-to-find, the 380, but where do you see the sort of trend going in terms of availability, you know, and what's become available and what's out there now?
I definitely see it, you know, lightening up. It has lightened up. I think, honest to goodness, our industry got hit by a whirlwind, you know, going back to, you know, in 2008, and everybody went, holy crap, time to stock up, you know. So it's coming back around. I think it's taking these manufacturers because, you know, they got hit hard too. They went, holy cow, wait a minute, we got a bunch of stuff in the warehouse. Now everybody and their cousins needing it, you know, or wanting it. And, you know, they're definitely keeping up with the demand. They are running around in circles trying to keep everybody supplied because you have to look at it from their angle too. It's not good for them when they don't have it. It's
right.
Not good for us, the shooters who enjoy our sport, you know, but from their standpoint, it's not good when they don't have it. So it's kind of a lose-lose type deal, you know, and they are catching up. I mean, they are working around the clock and trying to fill every order and get everything they can taken care of.
Do you find that that many retail level dealers are having difficulty selling through inventory when they may have purchased inventory at the panic prices? And then now they're kind of, maybe they've overbought or they're stuck with it, and now it's like, hey, how do I get rid of it? I mean, do you find people sort of stuck in that trap, or have most people been able to sort of skate through the slight downturn that we've had in the last, you know, 9 months or year or so?
No, I think most of them, most of them are good to go. You know, it's going to move. So I don't see any of them being stuck with it. I see ammo coming in waves. Like, 1 month you'll be inundated by 45 ACP. 1 month you'll have more 380 you can handle. You know, 1 month there'll be plenty of this or plenty of that. I think what a bunch of gun dealers need to do, and this is just, you know, me speaking from where I'm at now and from running the store myself, is to buy in advance. In that last year at hunting season, I'm going to use hunting season for example, you know, 30-30 was like the new 380 during hunting season. I mean, it was just, nobody had 30-30. You couldn't find it to save your soul. And 30-30 is so darn common. It's such a common round, but it wasn't there. And what I tell, you know, me, whenever me and you talk on the phone and you're buying and stuff like that is, you know, just get it while it's here and put it aside. Get it while it's here and put it aside. You know, and the same can be said for people buying, you know, ammo for themselves for personal use. Get it while it's here and put it aside. You know, one thing I've always done is, if I know I'm at the range and shoot 100 rounds, put 200 aside. You know?
Right.
And that way I've always got a stockpile, and I'll just work through that stockpile. So when the prices of ammo go up and down, like they always do, like during the stock market, I'm always covered, you know,
right.
Whether it be for home defense or whether it be for just enjoyment shooting with friends and family. So that's the main thing I would say is just always, you know.
Now, have you found, you know, you'd mentioned the 30-30, which brought to mind, obviously, that's everybody's favorite, you know, deer rifle, at least traditionally. Have you found that there's been much of a, I don't necessarily want to say a drop off, but has there been, you know, a paradigm shift, I guess would be the best way, in terms of, are people really switching from the traditional, you know, lever action 30-30, your bolt action 308, into the black rifle type, you know, Remington R15, or, you know, the you know, a 308 caliber black rifles, 6.8 caliber black rifles. You know, have you seen that in terms of trending as far as sales go? Are people getting away from your quote-unquote traditional, you know, bolt-action or lever-action hunting rifles and transitioning more and more enthusiastically towards the, you know, the AR platform, or at least the black rifle platform style for hunting?
Honest to goodness, I think that always try to, you know, encourage people to try something new. You know, that Remington R50, that's an awesome gun. I mean, you know, like anything else, it's got its ups and downs, but that's neither here nor there. But I always try to encourage people to have at least something new on their shelf. Everybody walks into a gun store, they'll automatically notice, you know, Winchester Model 94 sitting there. Oh, that's a Winchester. I killed my first deer with one of those. You know, or my dad gave me one of those, or my granddad. You know, you'll always have those people that always love their lever action gun, and they won't trade them for nothing in the world. Myself included, I love mine. You know, I've killed my first deer with a Winchester Model 94. But, you know, at the same time, like you said, it is a new time. You know, it's 2010. Let's try something different. Let's mix it up a little bit. And the AR style platform guns are great for hunting. They are fantastic. You know, they're a lot of fun just to even take to the range and just shoot. But, you know, so those have been selling really well. They really have. I sell a lot of them.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, you know, what I was saying with some of my previous guests was that, you know, it doesn't matter what you shoot. It doesn't matter what gun you own or you buy or you love or you talk about. The fact that you're participating And as far as a gun owner or from our end, as far as being whether you're an NRA instructor like myself or you're a gun shop owner or operator, whatever you want to call it, or from your end on the distribution side, that we educate people and that we, you know, make sure that everybody has a fun, positive, and safe experience through the whole thing.
You're absolutely right. And, I mean, one of the things that, you know, I've talked to you about with me and you talk at work is, you know, I mean, you know what I bought my daughter for her very first birthday, a Colt 1911.
Yes,
sir. My wife thought I was crazy, you know, but I said, hey, she needs a 1911. So we got her one. And my thing is this, when I look at her, that is the future of our sport. You know, I was always raised around guns, always had them around me. They weren't locked up, but I knew where they were, you know. And I think if I pass that on to her and her knowledge and get, you know, teach her and the right way to handle them, take her out shooting, show her what they can do, you know, and also teach her the fun side of the sport, because that's it. Whenever you get somebody young involved in our sport, it's got to be fun. You know, just like hunting. You can't take a 7-year-old hunting and put him in a tree stand and make him be quiet. You got to get him out there way before that. Get him walking in the woods, let him make noise, and you know what I mean, just have a good time and make it fun. Because that's what's going to carry us on way after me and you are gone, is to have our future, you know, insured in them. Because it is their right to have them, and I want to make sure that, you know, she has them.
Well, Reed, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I couldn't have ended the show any better myself than the comments that you just made at the closing. That was excellent, brother. I'll be speaking to you soon, and feel free to come on Radio Free ARFCOM anytime you would like to check in on the industry and things that go on. On that note, we're going to start wrapping it up with the general discussion on Zombie Central portion of AR15.com. Topic is things that an average person would do during a zombie apocalypse. The polls show that about 95% of the pie would taste delicious. Thanks for listening to Radio Free ARFCOM. My name is Benjamin. I had a great time with everybody. I hope you all had a great time. And we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. Have a great evening and tune in next Monday for our next show. We should have some good topics for you coming up. Thanks again. And have a wonderful day.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache.